I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. As a boomer kid growing up in the 50s and 60s, I read Mad Magazine. Although I didn't get all the jokes, I knew it was naughty. As I got older, I understood how the satire and the smart alecky, subversive, even tasteless humor was a perfect antidote to the times, skewering politicians, celebrities, consumerism, really almost everything. Its message was, don't trust authority. They're probably lying to you. Well, after 67 years, the, quote, usual gang of idiots is calling it a day with their final print edition of Mad on newsstands this month. The magazine, now owned by Time Warner, will recycle some old material with new covers and offer an occasional special edition. But while Mad is disappearing, it has left its mark. And today in Radio Times, we pay tribute to the magazine. We'll learn about its history and we'll discuss its legacy. Joining us by telephone is Joe Raiola. He's former senior editor at Mad Magazine. In fact, he was at Mad for 33 years. Joe, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, good morning. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And sitting across from me here in our Philadelphia studios is Maria Riedelbach. She's an author and artist, and back in 1991 wrote a book called Completely Mad, A History of the Comic Book and Magazine. And Maria, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hello, nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Joe, I'm going to begin with one of those how do you feel questions, but you were there for 33 years. How does it feel to have the magazine sort of shrunken in its impact?
You know, I'm getting tired of reading my own obituary.
Exactly, right. I get it.
I feel like I've read a thousand different versions. And by the way, I've read so many articles about Mad, I'm kind of cracking up as I read them. My longtime fellow senior editor at Mad for 33 years with me, Charlie Cadu, had a theory about the press and stories written in general. But his theory was that there was at least one mistake in every story. And I have not read a story about Mad recently that didn't have a mistake. Many
Yikes.
Have many more than that. And I'll tell you something else. I think that most of the stories I've read, I mean, pretty much all of them, with an exception or two, miss what, at least for me, what is a really a personal and important part of this. The, you know, Mad was in New York for 65 years.
Right.
Mad was in New York City through the end of 2017, and it was moved to Burbank with an entire new team. Now, just think about that. You're ripping something that has deep roots in one place for all this time. You're moving it 3,000 miles away, and you're starting with an editorial team without a single member of that team who had ever written a piece for Mad. We all of us on the old team, felt it was going to fail. We're sorry that we were right, but we're not surprised that it did indeed fail.
Well, Joe, we are live radio, so if there are mistakes, you can always correct them. That's one of the beauties of radio. Let me get Maria in on the conversation. I mean, 67 years, maybe it's 65 if you think about that move to California, but 67 years is a long time for a magazine. What are your thoughts?
Well, it is. It is. And in dog years or magazine years, you know, Mad's pretty elderly. But there are magazines that have certainly been around a lot longer, like The New Yorker. Vanity Fair was kind of reborn. But in many ways, Mad really managed to stay forever young. It always had really wonderful contributors, the usual gang of idiots. I think Joe and Charlie kept it really fresh during the time that they were the senior editors. I continue to enjoy it, or I did. I have my last issue. It arrived in my mailbox this week. I'm pretty sad about that. I thought that the new gang did some pretty interesting things, although I don't know. If you're going to reboot, it seems like you could have done something more different. And maybe the writing was on the wall when they shut down the New York office, which was a sad thing.
Sure. I mean, it has that kind of urban New York-y sensibility
to it.
Oh, yeah.
Mad Magazine is a New York City magazine.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Well, let's talk about William Gaines. Let me first get to you, Joe, because he hired you, correct?
He was out of his mind, and he did hire me. I remember what Bill said when he hired me. He said he was talking about our top editors at the time, John Ficarra and Nick Meglin. He said, "John and Nick tell me you're very talented. I don't believe them. I propose to pay you as little as possible."
And you took the job, right?
You know, the cool thing is I didn't take the job right away. He was talking to me and my pal Charlie, and we said, "Thank you very much. We'll think about it." And we came back the next week, and we said, "You know, we're really busy. We would love to work 3 days a week. You know, we'd each come in one day together, and then the other of us would work 2 days. What do you think about hiring us for 3 days a week?" And he said, "Yes."
Oh, you played hardball, and he said, "Yes."
So for many years at MAD, I worked a 16-and-a-half-hour week because that was a 10-to-5-day Gaines. It was 5.5 hours because Gaines was the proponent of the 90-minute lunch.
Well, I read about that, and he really believed that people who work for him should go out for lunch for 90 minutes?
He felt that you couldn't do anything in an hour. He felt that it wasn't enough time. If you had to go to the bank or you had to run an errand, that you didn't have sufficient time to eat. And as Maria could tell you, eating was a high priority for Bill. So the 90-minute lunch break was one of the perks of working at MAD.
Do you want to speak to that, Maria? Why Bill Gaines liked lunch or food so much?
He loved food, and he was really good at loving food. I took a couple of trips. Bill would take everybody on trips regularly.
The whole staff, right?
The whole staff and the contributors. I also got invited on a couple of those. And boy, he really knew his food. We did some very interesting food adventuring together. And really the fun kind, going into obscure places and fantastic.
Wow. Well, let me play something. This is actually 1954. This is William Gaines. At that time, he was publishing comic books, and he's testifying before Congress. And I should make he references a guy named Frederick Wortham, who was a psychiatrist who believed that comic books would lead to violent behavior among children. And here's William Gaines defending comic books.
"It would be just as difficult to explain the harmless thrill of a horror story to a Dr. Wortham as it would be to explain the sublimity of love to a frigid old maid. What are we afraid of? Are we afraid of our own children? Do we forget that they are citizens too and entitled to the essential freedom to read? Or do we think our children so evil, so vicious, so simple-minded that it takes but a comic magazine story of murder to set them to murder, of robbery to set them to robbery?"
Joe, does that sound like the guy you work for?
That sounds like the guy I work for. Bill, first of all, you could not win an argument with Bill. No one could win an argument with Gaines. And, of course, the United States Senate couldn't win an argument with Gaines. Although I think that Bill was, in a way, an unlikely First Amendment hero. He was steadfast in his opposition to the comic book code. He was steadfast in the work and the magazines that he was publishing, being free to have it was the opposite of his dad in every way. And Maria could speak to this as well. Bill's father, and this is one of the really fascinating things about Gaines, his father was Max Gaines, who is credited more or less with inventing or discovering, as the case may be, the American comic book. But his dad, Max, was a moralist. He was doing picture stories from the Bible and picture stories from science. He believed that comic books could educate children. And when he died, in a boating accident in Lake Placid, I believe, and turned over, and Bill inherited EC Comics, which had been Educational Comics. Well, Maria, why don't you pick it up from here and tell
well,
Bill,
go ahead, Maria.
What Bill did.
Bill was 21 years old, and his dad had been really hard on him. His father thought he was a klutz, that he would not be able to succeed, that he was a failure. And so, you know, Bill did not have a happy time growing up. Father was the high school principal, disciplinarian. And so 21, he inherits EC Comics, and he thinks about it a minute, and he thinks, well, I'm going to do what I want to do. And I like to read science fiction, and I like to read horror. And so he started producing some fabulous horror, science fiction, crime, and war comics. Weird Science, Tales from the Crypt, comics that are now considered classic golden era comics. And it was among that group that Mad was included.
In fact, I have, I think, a picture of, is this the first, I'm holding this up on the radio, and that's really Tales Calculated to Drive You Mad.
Indeed. That was the first. It had a macabre aspect as well.
But it seems like he also was very clever in that after testifying before Congress and, you know, they went after the comic books, he changed it, Maria, to a magazine, what, to get around the censors?
He did, yeah. The distributors were refusing to carry any comic book that didn't have the seal of approval, which the new comics book code was based on the Hays Code that had been used in movies. So, you know, good had to always prevail. People... Married couples had to sleep in separate beds. You know, there was all this kind of puritanical layer of censorship over everything. And Bill wouldn't do that. And so he converted Mad into a, quote, magazine, started using typesetting, put some, pages of text inside, and managed to slip around the distributor's sanctions.
Very clever. Joe, about a minute or so before our first break here, do you remember the first Mad magazine you read?
I don't remember the cover or the issue number, but I remember the first thing I read in Mad that changed my life. It was Off We Go Into the Lunchroom Yonder, Shoving Girls Out of the Way, Forward Boys, Move On Down That Counter, Hurry Up, Fill the tray, try the beans they prepared last Friday, and the meat is tough as a mule, the bread's got mold, the soup is cold, yuck, anything beats the lunchroom at our school. Frank Jacobs.
Oh, yeah. I remember
Joe. I have the lyrics to the Dentist song. Same music. Off we go into the wide mouth yonder, looking for molars to fill.
Well, you know, Frank probably wrote, I bet, 10 to 20 parodies of a lot of those patriotic songs. But that's the battle hymn we're doing, right?
Exactly.
The battle hymn of the Republic?
Yep, yep.
Yeah, and he would do, you know, he would spoof over there and things like that. I loved Jacobs. Most people, I think, fell in love with Mad because of the art. I fell in love with Mad first because of the writing.
That's Joe Raiola, former senior editor at Mad Magazine. In fact, worked for the magazine for 33 years. Maria Reidelbach is with us as well. She's an author, artist, and back in 1991 wrote a book called Completely Mad, A History of the Comic Book and Magazine. We got comments coming in. You can also call us 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this very short break.
Excuse me, is this Mad Magazine?
No, it's Mademoiselle. We're buying our sign on the installment plan.
Seriously, though, my name is Bart Simpson. My father has a subscription. I'd like the grand tour, please.
Listen, kid, you probably think lots of crazy stuff goes on in there, but this is just a place of business.
Oh, okay.
Give me Kaputnik and Phone Bone. I want to see the drawings for the New Kids on the Block. And where's my Verschlagener pastrami sandwiches?
Wow. I will never wash these eyes again.
Bart Simpson on Mad Magazine, and all that ruckus you heard is the door opens to the writer's room, and there is total mayhem inside. So, Joe, what was it like to write or to write and edit for Mad Magazine?
I used to think of it as a comedy sweatshop.
Meaning it was tough.
Yeah, come on, how tough is it when you make fun of people for a living? We would get in and start making fun of each other, and we did that for a while. It was a, I'm going to say, a comedically vicious, totally uncensored, politically incorrect environment. The kind of environment that you might not be able to have in corporate America now. Right. You know, MAD was corporately owned. Bill sold MAD to corporate interests in the 60s, and it was Time Warner. It was Time and Time Warner and AOL Time Warner and all that. But MAD really, while corporately owned, functioned creatively independently from corporate forces. When I went out to California a couple of months ago, when I was performing out there and visited the new office, I was told that one of the recent corporate decrees was that they were no longer allowed to use the word Eskimo in the office.
What?
Okay, that's true. I was told that the classic MAD spoof of Forrest Gump that we did called Forrest Trump, which we did before Trump was a politician, which used the word retard, had been taken off of the wall where it had been for years because someone complained about the use of the word. What I'm trying to get at is the environment in which, from which MAD sprung, the creative environment, was loose, free, sometimes way over the top. We'd make the filthiest jokes, the most tasteless jokes that we would never use in the magazine. But in the freedom to do that, we would find our way to really good material that would go in the magazine. Comedy needs that environment to thrive. I don't know if it's possible now in a magazine owned by AT&T, Time Warner. Maybe it is. I hope it is, but I'm not sure.
No, interesting. Maria and I were talking about this before going on the air. It seemed to have a kind of a boy's sensibility. And Maria, I know that you were an Army kid growing up, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And was Mad Magazine sort of your link to America?
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, that was what our little family tribe read. And I mentioned, Joe, how, you know, I grew up with three brothers and a very butch sister. And so it was a very kind of a testosterone-y family. And but I didn't feel odd for being a girl and loving Mad. I mean, I think that you guys have a lot more female fans than most people realize, don't you?
I think that's probably true anecdotally, what we believe and what our research shows, the little research that we actually did, was that most of our female readers got to MAD through male readers, meaning brother would share it with sister.
Yeah.
And that's how most female readers came to MAD. The readership was always largely male and with a very odd demographic. A lot of teen readers, young readers and teen readers, and then a gap, not a lot of college-age readers, at least in the last 20 or 30 years, and then readers over 30.
Huh. Interesting. Interesting. Well, it was my brother that introduced me to Mad Magazine, so that really fits your theory there, Joe. Let me read some comments. One from Virginia. She says, the end of an era. This is about what's happening to Mad Magazine. She said, I read my first issue in about fifth grade at my eye doctor's office. My brother and I kept reading it on our own for years after. An email from Robert. He said, I started reading Mad Magazine in the mid-50s as a young boy, and it helped form my sense of humor to this day. The artists, including caricature artists, were incredible. I mean, the artwork, and I have to say, Maria, you and I both have the latest and I guess final print edition. The artwork is very familiar.
Oh, yeah, it is still very familiar. And it's extraordinary. Some of the art in MAD is some of the best art being done in comics, and it always has been. MAD's always placed a huge value, Joe and Charlie and the other editors. It has been spectacular in that way.
Joe, let me read an email from Bernie who says, the infamous Mad flag hung on my bedroom wall, striped with offensive slurs that comprise a brilliant anti-bigotry message. Sometimes offensive humor can best convey an important social message, but nobody can get away with that today. I think it's sad that today's political correctness and hypersensitivity killed the marketability of the satire that Mad magazine provided. Joe, do you agree with that?
Well, I certainly agree that political correctness is very unhealthy for comedy. Comedy cannot thrive in an environment of political correctness, although I don't agree that it was political correctness that killed Mad. I think that Mad was surviving against the odds because of the team that was dedicated to it. I mean, I don't mean to get too pretentious here and make this sound Buddhist, but this was a comedy lineage passed on from Harvey Gaines and Bill and Harvey Kurtzman and Bill Gaines, Harvey being Mad's first editor, Al Feldstein, editor for 28 years. Nick Meglin was there during that time. Nick Meglin became editor. John Ficarra came on board. Nick moved on. John stayed. Charlie and I were there. This was a lineage. This was a was a fierce group of a great group of editors and writers and artists who made this thing live. And that lineage stopped. And I think that's what killed Mad. I think had Mad stayed in New York, and listen, forgive me to the extent that there's ego in here, there may be some, but I truly believe that had Mad stayed in New York, it would still be going, because they broke the thing that made Mad Mad, which was the unique group of people that put it together.
Maria, it looks like you want to add something.
Oh, well, I just as far as humor goes and political correctness, Harvey Kurtzman, the original editor, had some really interesting things to say about that, and I think that they were things that kind of got written into the DNA of Mad in many ways, and that is that humor, even if it's biting, if it's generous, and if it's empathetic, and if it strives for some sort of truth, I think it's really fair game, even if it's cutting, and you know, at its best. That's what Mad was. I mean, every issue was uneven.
Yeah.
And, you know, having read all of them in the span of a couple of years, oh, that was such a dream job. when I was writing the book, you know, that unevenness was very apparent. But you're going to have that, you know, with any kind of comedic enterprise. But the very best humor had real humanity at its core. Don't you think, Joe?
Yeah, I mean, there are two things come to mind listening to you. I mean, yes, and I appreciate you saying that. We had one kind of in-house rule at Mad, which is we did not engage in what we considered victim humor. Mm-hmm. We didn't make fun of cancer patients. We didn't make fun of people who were victims of a tsunami or a natural disaster. We did our best not to make victims of the make fun of the downtrodden and things like that, because honestly, there's no fun in punching
sure.
down.
Sure.
The Mad's targets were always the powerful, the pretentious, priests, politicians, those in charge of the culture, businessmen, etc. So, yeah, there was, in that sense, a kind of, let's say, let's call it a morality. A lot of comedians and comedy writers are moralists in some sense. So there is that's absolutely true. And then the other thing you were saying that I wanted to respond to, Maria, I forgot.
Fair enough. That happens all the time and certainly happens on radio. That's Joe Raiola. He's a former senior editor at Mad Magazine. He was at the magazine for 33 years. Maria Reitelbach wrote a book back in 1991 called Completely Mad, A History of the Comic Book and Magazine. She was essentially embedded at the offices of Mad Magazine to write the book. And why are we talking about Mad Magazine? Well, after 67 years, this uniquely American institution has ended a
run of sorts, having just published its final print edition of all original content. And on the cover, it's a special Tarantino Time Warp issue. You can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me ask a couple of different questions about some of the things that we associate with Magazine, of course, Alfred E. Newman. I read that it was a takeoff on Prince Charles with his big ears. I also read it was an ad that someone found for a dentist named Painless Romaine. I also read that it was a person featured in a high school biology textbook, a person who lacked iodine. Those were all descriptions of where this image came from. Joe, can I toss that to you? And Maria, I'd love to have you weigh in as well. Where did Alfred E. Newman come from?
I think that I wonder if Maria would agree with this, that the answer to that question is hazy.
Really?
We don't know for sure. Yes, Alfred appeared in an advertisement for a dentist, I believe out of Topeka, Kansas, and then the ad said, "What me worry, painless dentistry." But there are images of the gap tooth idiot kid that predate that. I think of Alfred as the archetypal fool. You know, if you look at the fool in the tarot, the fool is not to be confused with an idiot. There are fools who are idiots, but there's in the tarot the fool has a certain wisdom. If you see him in the card, he's dancing on the edge. Oblivious to the fact that he's on the edge and there's a dog barking, warning him that if he's not careful, he could fall off. I think of the Blakean quote, "The fool who persists in his folly becomes wise." To me, Alfred is kind of a modern day depiction of that character.
Oh, that's really interesting. Maria, what do you see in that face?
Well, I'm very fond of Alfred E. Newman's face, I have to say. But Joe, something that I've learned since writing the book and in the last few years is there's a postal worker in New York City who has taken it upon himself to really discover the origins of the Alfred E. Newman face, and I think he actually has.
Really?
And he has gone back further than anything that I included in my book to a play that was performed in the, I believe, 1870s. And it might have been called Peck's Bad Boy. I'm not sure. It's something with the word boy in it. Anyway, he contacted me. He actually was one of my neighborhood postal workers in the city. And I think he really has found the origin. He has yet to go public with his information.
Who played this part, or just...
It was an illustration for the play. It was like a cover for a playbill or an advertisement or something.
What's the name of it again?
Play? I'd have to look it up. It might have been Peck's Bad Boy. That's not quite right. But
interesting. But what's interesting to me is after 67 years, we still don't know the answer to this question. Right? It's still
well, Alan
out
is
there.
Keeping a lid on it. I think I'm not sure why, but it's kind of his info.
Can you talk, Joe, about Spy versus Spy? This was a Cuban-born cartoonist, correct?
Antonio Prohias, who was an editorial cartoonist in Cuba during the Castro era, who was pissing off Castro. Now, I don't know a lot, actually, about the specific nature of the cartoons that Antonio was doing back then, but suffice to say what we do know is they were pissing off the communist regime, and they considered Prohias an enemy of the state, and he fled.
Oh, wow. And fled to what, Mad Magazine?
Well, he fled to Florida first.
And then made his way to Mad Magazine.
And then he made his way to Mad. And one of his brainchilds, and the most famous, of course, is Spy versus Spy, which some people think was about race. And it was never about race. Spy versus Spy was really about the futility of war. The thing about the black spy and the white spy, yes, they're constantly fighting, but we don't know what they're fighting for. We don't know who the good guy is or who the bad guy is. One of them is always victorious over the other, but it doesn't stop the conflict. The conflict just starts again, and the only time they both lose is when the lady spy enters, and it's spy versus spy versus spy, and she always defeats them both.
Oh, there you go. Maria, I mean, it had its roots in the Cold War originally.
Yes.
And it has a kind of Tom and Jerry feel
to
it.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. Yeah, definitely Tom and Jerry. It's one of the interesting aspects of the original MAD contributors is that many of them were first-generation Americans. And that, I find that fascinating. There was a real diversity among the contributors because of that. Don't you think, Joe?
Yeah, that's very interesting. The idea
True.
Of first gen. Yeah, go ahead, Joe.
Well, I'm imagining that you're thinking of Sergio.
Yeah.
Sergio who?
Sergio Paul Peter Porges.
Sergio Aragonés. Sergio Aragonés, most famous in MAD for the marginals, that those little drawings that would just appear out of nowhere on multiple pages of the magazine, and the long-running feature MAD look at with his really unique pantomime style. I mean, Sergio, without question, one of MAD's most famous. And
I mean, even Al Jaffe grew up partly in Latvia.
But do you think, Maria, there was something that sort of immigrant, that first gen, that immigrant sensibility that fit with MAD magazine?
Yes. Well, their viewpoint, their perspective on American culture was particularly interesting, I think, because they came from the outside. And
then, maybe felt like misfits.
Yeah. And then the core group of MAD Mag, the original MAD magaziners, were all graduates of New York City, and a lot of them went to the High School of Music and Art. And so, you know, they were pals since high school.
Well, we are talking about the origins, the history, the legacy of MAD magazine. Again, that's Maria Riedelbach. She's an author. She's an artist. Wrote a book back in 1991 called Completely MAD, A History of the Comic Book and Magazine. Joe Raiola joining us by telephone. He spent 33 years at MAD magazine as a senior editor. And you can join us. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us. WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Oh my God, the MAD Magazine Special Edition. They only put out 17 of these a year.
Boy, they're really socking it to that Spiro Agnew guy again. He must work there or something.
Let's do the fold-in.
Okay. What higher power do TV evangelists worship?
I'll say God.
I'll say Jesus. The Almighty Dollar.
You fold it, you bought it.
The famous fold-in MAD magazine. Any chance we get to play Simpsons, we do that. And, of course, The Simpsons and MAD magazine, perfect together. Can you, Maria, talk a little bit about the fold-in, where that came from?
Oh, the fold-in. Yeah. Al Jaffe, one of the first amazing contributors to MAD. And he's still living and contributed to this last issue. Pretty amazing. Well, MAD Magazine, the first issues when it became a magazine, it parodied other magazines. And so they would do these parodies of Look and Life, these big picture magazines that were kind of new in the late 50s. And, of course, Playboy also was new in the late 50s, and they had a fold out, which, you know, revealed the voluptuous centerfold gal of the month. So MAD Magazine, cheapskates as they are, couldn't do a fold out. So they decided to do a fold in. And they did it as a one-off, but it was so popular that they continued to do it every month forever.
You know, Joe, in that clip, mention of Spiro Agnew, and one of the Simpsons characters says, sort of indicating that people wanted to be, I guess, parodied in MAD Magazine. Was that true?
It wasn't true when I started at MAD, but it became true. I started writing for MAD in 1984. became an editor in 1985. Back then, for example, movie studios didn't want to be made fun of in Mad. They didn't want their movie mocked. They didn't want to cooperate with us or help us in any way. But that began to change pretty quickly after I started at Mad, and it wasn't long before movie studios got wise, and they would start sending us press kits.
Wow.
And they'd say, please spoof us in the magazine. And I think that's symptomatic of how the Mad voice has kind of been adopted to some extent by the whole culture. Also, I wanted to say that I remembered the point that I wanted to make before. Maria had mentioned that reading Mads over the years for her, she found it uneven. And I think that that's absolutely true. And I liken that to watching 90 minutes of Saturday Night Live. Now, how many people actually watch 90 minutes of Saturday Night Live now? You see the highlights now. You see the best stuff. But if you watch a whole Saturday Night Live show, how much of it, how much of the comedy in it, say there's an hour of comedy after you take the commercials out and the music out, how much of that comedy is great? How much of it's good? How much of it is, not bad, and how much of it stinks? I still don't know after all these years what a good batting average is. Most of the stuff that we said and wrote was pretty bad, but didn't end up in the magazine. Our best stuff is in the magazine, and probably as much as half of that is just, but the stuff that's really good and the very best of the stuff, you know, that's what you live for.
Sure,
as a comedy
writer. Cindy says, I loved Mad. I was reading it since I was a kid, especially some of the movie spoofs, seeing some of the content through adult eyes. I couldn't help but notice some of the stuff was pretty sexist. Even with that, I still love Mad Magazine. And we did play the clip from William Gaines from 1954, where he talks about the a frigid old maid. And Maria and I looked at each other and kind of rolled our eyes. So some things have changed. Let me get Chris. He's been very patient hanging on from Frankfurt. And Chris, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there, Chris. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, very quickly, I just wanted to say I discovered Mad Magazine. My father, and I'm 68 years old now, but my father read it, and back when it was kind of like a paperback book for him. So I still remember some of the things. Super Duper Man was pretty funny.
Mm-hmm.
And I was that was a hilarious take on Superman. And I remember Sergio Aragon's and his margin cartoons and some of the extraordinary Mort Drucker, I guess, would be at the top of the heap for me.
Sure.
But my question was, I'm just curious to know what some of the writers and people who contributed and the artists and so forth are doing now.
Well, Joe,
if they're not completely retired.
Yeah, so. Chris, can you answer that? I mean, especially some of the people that are our caller referenced.
Well, speaking for myself, I mean, the one thing I've been doing longer than I was at Mad in 1981, I started producing the annual John Lennon tribute here in New York City, and I'm still producing the annual John Lennon tribute in New York City, which will take place this year on December 6th, with Natalie Merchant. And so I'm still doing that, and I'm still performing. I've been performing around the country a First Amendment show called The Joy of Censorship, so I'm still doing that. I was doing that stuff at Mad. I'm doing more of it now since I'm not at Mad. And I think, you know, some of the Mad guys, some of the older guys were moving toward retirement. But, you know, everyone finds their way. I know a bunch of the, at least recent Mad editors have moved on to other work. John Ficaris had quite a bit of work published in the last year, various websites. So, you know, life goes on.
Yeah, there's life after Mad. Maria, anything you want to add to that?
Well, I know that in recent years, Mad has started featuring the art of a number of alternative comics creators. And they, of course, all still have their own careers going, which are wonderful to follow with graphic novels and alternative comics.
I mean, the comic book world is just exploding.
Oh, it's wonderful. It really has blossomed
Something
and
for
has
everybody.
Become recognized as the true art form that it is. So people like Peter Cooper and I think you have Drew Friedman once in a while.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And they still are thriving.
Here's an email.
I will say that, you know, as editors of Mad, you know, myself, Charlie, John, Nick, the four top editors during my 33 years there, we didn't think of Mad as a comic book. John, myself, and Charlie, we didn't grow up on the Harvey Kurtzman Mad. We grew up on the Al Feldstein Mad of the 60s.
Hmm.
We viewed Mad as a magazine. And, you know, there were had some comic book features in it, but even the crossover between comic book fans and Mad magazine,
mm-hmm.
not what you would think it would be. Mad was sold on the newsstand. Yeah, you could buy it in some comic book shops, but there was never a giant crossover between comic book fans and Mad magazine fans, I would argue.
Would you say, Joe, that newsstands are going to go the way of Mad magazine then?
Mm. Yeah, I mean,
sadly.
Newsstands, you know, what is a newsstand? I mean, Mad was largely in recent years available at Barnes & Noble and Walmart. Because the newsstands more or less have gone. So whether there'll be a newsstand in 5 years or 10 years, I don't know. I don't know if the newsstand will make it or not. Hopefully Mad will revive itself. It should revive itself, whether it does or not. The impact is in the comedy world is really incalculable.
Sure, and I do want to... Yeah, go ahead, Maria.
It sounds like there are some people out there who are going to revive Mad, whether it's a corporate, you know, whether it's a Time Warner version or not. Have you been following that, Joe?
I have been following that, and again, I'm again, I'll if this comes off as ego, fine. The Mad voice is something that could really, I mean, I knew it as a kid. Of course I knew it. A lot of us have it in us in some way. But the Mad voice is something that, as I think of it, had to be learned in the comedy trenches of Mad. It's not something that could be assigned. You could call something, listen, I'm going to say this. We know that there were countless Mad magazine impersonators. There was Cracked, which was the longest running one, and Sick and Crazy, et cetera, et cetera. Even EC Comics put an imitator out called Panic Years.
Ooh, what
ago.
About Eh? I liked Eh.
But my take is this. When Cracked went out of business, we thought we had seen the last Mad Magazine impersonator, but it turned out that the last Mad Magazine impersonator was Mad itself.
Oh, so interesting.
Because, and this is not a shot at any of the team in the West Coast that tried to do this, they didn't have the voice because they couldn't have the voice. They never wrote for the magazine. They were not in the comedy trenches of Mad. They didn't, and it was something that had to be absorbed into one's comedy DNA. They didn't have that benefit. So, listen, as a brand, can Mad survive? Maybe, sure. Listen, they've been trying to revive National Lampoon since all the geniuses who left Lampoon, and maybe Lampoon will have a life as a brand again, but it could never be what it was when Sean Kelly was there and Tony Hendra was there and all the great Manny Simmons, et cetera, who made Lampoon.
You know,
that's not how comedy works.
And I'm thinking, I don't know about, I was always a fan of Garbage Pail Kids, and I always thought that was such a...
There were some good artists behind
that always reminded me of Mad Magazine.
Well, I mean, the thing is that everybody's golden age of Mad was the time at which they first discovered it and they were really into it, you know? And,
true.
You know, the golden age of Mad is a very personal thing for each person, I find.
Well, Maria, let me ask you, Joe talks about the voice, and what I think of is a kind of irreverence and childish, but fun,
mm-hmm.
Politically incorrect. How would you describe the Mad magazine voice?
Yeah, I would say that's true. I mean, I think that they, when Al Feldstein took over from Harvey Kurtzman, I think that he was much more of a practical, business-oriented editor. So he looked at what Harvey had done, which was very uneven, but full of genius, and took some of the best bits and then made them into templates that they were able to use successfully to create more and more fantastic content. That said, there was definitely a sensibility at the office at MAD that was, you know, it was very much a kind of a tribe there, and the voice was very strong.
But do you, Maria, do you see that in, let's say, The Onion or Stephen Colbert or The Simpsons?
Oh,
or,
yeah.
I mean,
oh, absolutely.
That voice, I think, still
that,
lives
that,
on.
That each, oh, I see, the MAD, it's different for each each venue, I think. But, I mean, I think MAD was so influential that they have spawned all kinds of bad attitudes all over the place.
Let me read an email from Paul. He says, MAD may have influenced the field of music therapy. We music therapists use familiar in songs in therapy sessions, but rewrite the lyrics to express a client's concerns or wishes or treatment goals. These recomposed songs often provide for alternative perspectives for the client's life. Used in group music therapy, this method provides for group cohesion. Very interesting. And we were all singing songs from MAD magazine. Let me toss something else out here. In 2016, Rolling Stone said MAD magazine was the best political satire magazine in the country, which gets us to Joe, really this talk about the role of MAD when it comes to politics and political humor. I have to say, in this new MAD magazine edition, there's some parodies of President Trump, Ivanka Trump, Jared Kushner. It's all in there. How important is it to have something like MAD that's just, you know, biting at the heels of whoever's in the White House?
It's, I think, tremendously important. MAD has a long history of political satire, great political satire. Every president, every elected president, Gerald Ford, not counting Ford, since JFK, has been on the cover of MAD. We were relentless in our Trump material, relentless. I got to say that we took it very personally, like the entire comedy world did. When Trump won, we took it bad, because we did everything possible to make fun of him, mock him, take him down. And I think a lot of comedians did. And I remember joking about that. Some people say, boy, satire is so important. I said, yeah, it is, but maybe it's not important. And maybe it's not as important as actually voting. Yeah, we had a very sharp edge. And I think of the 65-year run at MAD as being bookended with two famous quotes. You mentioned one, Rolling Stone, that was actually in end of 2017, said right. MAD, America's best political satire magazine, and it was famously Time magazine that in the 50s, the famous quote from Time magazine is, MAD magazine, a short-lived satirical pulp.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Maria. You were mouthing those words.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, the interesting thing is that in today's climate, it almost seems like MAD could really be very important, because our population has become so insulated from each other. I know that there are kids out there who don't really get exposed to progressive ideas or even, you know, a variety of ideas because of their religion or because of their cultural group. And, you know, I really see that, a magazine like MAD could play a role there in just showing kids that there are other ways to think.
Well, you know what? We have to end our conversation. My thanks to both of you very much for joining us today on Radio Times. Joe Raiola, thank you very much.
It's really been fun. Thanks for having me on. And Maria, great to connect with you.
Oh, yeah. We'll see you at
something, right. Joe Raiola, former senior editor at MAD Magazine, and Maria Reidelbach, thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. She's an author, an artist, and again, her 1991 book is called Completely MAD, A History of the Comic Book and Magazine. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. You can find us on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen, with help today from Xavier Lopez. I'm Marty Moscowain. Thank you so much for joining us.